From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Josh Hanegarny's book isn't just about his life with Tourette's syndrome, but let's start there. He describes it as having the same sense you feel when you need to sneeze. It's an urge, a pressure that builds up in various body parts, and wherever it is, he says, he has to let it out. That's where the tics come from, and they appear in different forms, hoops and screams and lurches. Another part of Josh's story, though, is that he's a librarian, which he says is the ultimate test for someone who literally cannot sit still. Josh Hanegarny is joining us today to talk about his book. He calls it a memoir of Tourette's, but it's also about faith and strength. We'll talk about his struggle for willpower and patience and what he calls the limits of human absurdity. The world's strongest librarian, after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West of Doug Fabrizio. So you'd think the hardest thing for Josh Hanegarny about writing a memoir would have been the Tourette's part. Josh has Tourette syndrome, which you may know is characterized by these involuntary verbal and physical tics. And you're going to hear some of them today. He twitches, he hoots, he even screams from time to time. And yes, the Tourette's is probably the, hook for the book. But you get a sense reading his life story that dealing with the Tourette syndrome has been just as difficult as some of the other personal struggles in his life, like dealing with an inexorable decline in his faith. Suffice it to say, it's a life that presented a lot of questions, and it was in the library where he says he found he could ask any question he wanted. He also learned that not every question has an answer. His book is called The World's Strongest Librarian, and he's joining us. Josh is a librarian at the Salt Lake City Public Library. He's written for years about his battle with Tourette's and his love of the library. Josh Hanegarny is joining us here in the studio. And welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I've been looking forward to it.
I want to get this the Tourette syndrome out of the way here a little bit first, because we're going to be hearing some of its manifestations here. Is it harder in a situation like this where you're talking to me? Does it manifest itself more, or is this just the way it is?
This will actually be really easy for me because you'll notice when I'm talking, I'm not having tics. So for anybody who wants to picture this, while I'm talking, I'm right up by the microphone. And as soon as I stop talking and I'm listening to Doug, I will lean way away to try to balance the scales because I'll suddenly have the urge to yell into the microphone. So for all the fear of public speaking and stuff like that, I've done so much of it. The bigger the crowd, the easier it is for me.
Wow.
'Cause that's kind of when I rest is there's nothing better for me than having a 1 hour one-sided conversation with no tics.
Okay. Well, I want to start with you write in the book that this relationship with libraries really began in Moab, where you were raised. And you write about the first time you entered a library, you were just over a year old. You owned a lot of books, but you say you usually had nearly as many checked out from the library. So it's all about libraries, at least at first. So the question is, what was it? What is it about a library?
Well, what was it was a question I wouldn't need to answer for a long time. I see this every day in the kids who come into our library. You can tell the kids who never had a chance not to love the place.
Yeah.
It was just always part of the day. It was just normal. You know, you went to the library the same way you brushed your teeth. It felt weird if you didn't do it. So I was not very aware that not everybody loved the library and not every kid loved to read more than to play outside. And of course, this has changed throughout my life. And nowadays, I look at that place and generally, when people ask me, why libraries? What's the big deal? I'm still waiting for somebody to come up with a downside to libraries when I say, why not?
Yeah.
What are you talking about? If we want to get real grandiose, I would say a library is the opposite of ignorance. And ignorance is what causes fear. And ignorance is what leads to hate. And I think we heard that from Yoda, first of all. But the library is the opposite of all the things I hate. And it's a perfect symbol of everything I love about life and all the things that make life exhilarating.
Yeah.
It's nothing but a giant mass of unasked questions.
I can't tell if you came to the library just because you had always loved the library, or if it was in some way a way of you being able to kind of test your willpower and deal with your Tourette syndrome.
It was both, yeah. And it was probably more as well. It took me 10 years of pecking away at my English degree up at the University of Utah to finally get done. Most of you English majors will probably agree that that is nothing but a springboard into more school. And I had started working at the library maybe a year or two earlier. And originally, yeah, I loved everything about the library. I didn't know if I'd be able to work there. And that was part of the charm originally, because for me to be at the library, I have to minute by minute pay attention to what's happening and figure out, how do I deal with the ticks? How do I make the next minute better than this one? It forces me to keep asking and paying attention in a way that I wouldn't if I felt safer, like at home on my couch, for example.
Yeah.
So that was part of it as well. And then it just so happened that the University of North Texas sent these two extremely sassy, honey-tongued library school recruiters, and I just, like, I couldn't get my credit card out fast enough. You would have too. I mean, they were very good, which would have different kinds of implications down the road. But that's kind of the least you need to know about it. Of course the books, of course the philosophical stuff, but also it challenges me in a way I need. So it's interesting now that I have these other options opening up with the speaking and the writing, and people just seem thunderstruck when I say, I don't think I can leave. I don't think I can have the same kind of life outside of libraries, even though that means I deal with some of the things I deal with there, and I make $39,000 a year for the rest of my life.
You know, it's interesting. You say that when you're talking, everything is cool, like it, you know, for the most part. But you also have said that you can't really sit down and write for more than a half an hour at a time. The ticks won't let you.
It depends. The ticks are often very circumstantial, meaning whatever it is I want to do or need to do, it tends to mold itself to whatever will make it the most obnoxious. So if I'm typing, I mean, and I'm doing this and I have a deadline I need to meet, pretty soon the urge will shift and I'll want to be like hitting the keyboard with my fingers and going like this. It's all just so weird. So like I have tics at the library I don't have anywhere else. I have tics at home that I only have at home. I have tics when I'm typing that I only have when I'm typing. So you just never know. I say I'm terrified of being bored, and I'm never really being bored, but it's not always a good thing.
At what point I read once where you had described the process of getting a book deal as getting an offer for a book you didn't want to write.
That was the first one.
The first one, okay.
Yeah, I mean,
I wasn't sure if you were referring to this one. I mean, so when did you start thinking about writing a memoir about all of this?
Well, what happened was I had started the blog literally just to keep track of my workout numbers, because I kept losing my notebooks. That was the whole story. Never planned on anyone reading it.
Yeah.
The fitness community online, though, is fairly tight-knit, so I did have people who would check in on my workouts and leave comments. And soon I was writing about what I was reading or maybe even what was going on with Tourette's, because I knew that people who knew me and would want these updates were reading it. Anyway, after about 2 months of the blog that nobody was supposed to read, the marketer and author and entrepreneur Seth Godin, who I was aware of, suddenly sent me an email out of nowhere saying, you should be writing a book. I'm sending this to my agent.
Yeah.
So about 48 hours later, that agent was my agent.
Wow.
And when she said, what's the book? I kind of said, what book? You know, I don't know. That was 4 years ago, and it took us a long time to get to this book. The offer I talked about turning down was an offer that happened quickly based on a proposal we just kind of threw together.
Yeah.
And it was a modest offer for a mass market paperback that was just kind of going to be goofy stories about Tourette's. And I didn't really want to write that book, and that's kind of what I meant. But also, things were happening so easily. Like, hey, Seth wrote to me. I knew the next offer would come really quickly.
Yeah.
And then like 4 years of nothing went by until we finally got to the proposal that would sell this book. And so many things changed even in my story during those 4 years that whatever the book was going to be had to keep changing as well. And we had to keep retooling things.
Yeah.
And once I finally knew what it was going to be, it was a pretty quick sell.
Do you think of yourself as a writer?
Yeah, I do, among many other things. I don't, it doesn't need to have a capital A on it or anything. Or no, author has an A, writer has a W.
Yeah.
No capital A's,
yeah,
no capital W's.
Okay, so let's talk about your experience in the library when you were a kid. Cat in the Hat gives way to Encyclopedia Brown, gives way to Harriet the Spy, to The Great Brain. And then came Charlotte's Web.
Yes.
Your first book, really, that you read truly by yourself, at least as I understand it. And in some ways, I guess, this was kind of your first love, too, in some ways. Fern was your first love in Charlotte's Web.
Yeah, not in some ways, in all the ways that matter. my mom tells a story of us bringing home Charlotte's Web, and I didn't know anything about it. It was a book. That was pretty much all I needed to know. And she came in and she caught me looking at one of these first pictures. And there's this picture on I think it's on page 14 of Fern, the farmer's daughter, who has saved the piglet and is going to raise him. And she's cradling him in her arms. And she is looking down at him with this look of what I would later recognize as absolutely unconditional love. And all I knew was that I wanted someone to look at me this way.
Yeah.
And as you keep flipping the pages, the pictures just get – they just get better and worse in this way, because then she's pushing him in a stroller. And he just looks so happy. And she's looking at him so sweetly. And then there's this page where he's in the pigsty doing pig things, and she's – resting her forearms on the fence, and her chin is on her forearms. And
we all know this image.
Yes.
I know that image so well.
And she's just gazing at him. And that's what I can say is I wanted someone to look at me that way. And so I wanted to be Wilbur. I would look in the mirror. I would practice making the same faces at myself. But that was – yeah. So, yeah, kind of Fern, my first real love. But also the first time I really remember feeling like someone fictional could be real.
Yeah.
And I'd only see some of this in hindsight later, but when people talk about, you know, fiction being a waste of time, like there's every bit as much truth in fiction as nonfiction, because it all just comes down to stories. And stories make you react to them.
Yeah.
And that's how I reacted to Fern.
The first time, or one of the first times that your Tourette's becomes apparent, is during this Thanksgiving play you write about when you're in elementary school. And so you get these tics. You're curling your upper lip, you're blinking your eyes, you're jerking your head. Your parents noticed, you say, but you didn't really. So I guess the question is, you weren't at that time consciously aware of the tics in those early days?
That recollection is theirs. So I can only go on what they told me.
Right.
And they say I didn't seem to be aware of it, because when they asked me afterwards if I was okay, I apparently just said, yeah, why? I didn't say, no, I keep blinking and moving my lips around.
Yeah. There's a moment – this I want to have you read this section in the book. It's right after this happens, I guess, and your mother is talking to you about this. Again, this is a recollection, I guess you say, that came from your parents. But do you want to read this section for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So my mom has just asked me she tells me that I'm still doing it.
Yeah. The stuff that you were doing that
yes.
she saw in the play. Right?
And I say, what do you mean? Mom curled her upper lip and touched her nose with it. She blinked her eyes rapidly at the same time, then in intervals of forceful winking with either eye. She jerked her head back and forth as if trying to toss away some hair that had fallen over her eyes. She stretched her neck to its limit like a turtle, then bobbed her head backward and forward like a chicken. Like that. Do you think you could stop? Do I really look like that? She made a deal with me. If you quit doing that for 5 minutes, I'll buy you a new book, she said. Mom, I'm sorry, I said, after lasting only 1 minute before the tics returned. Lips and nose and tongue and eyes. Up and down. Over and over and back again. Now that Mom had pointed it out, I was more aware of doing it. Not always, but often. I didn't like it that she wanted me to stop. If it were a good thing, she wouldn't care. It feels weird if I don't do it. Am I really doing it all the time? Mom became convinced that what I was doing wasn't a deliberate behavior. She felt so bad about this that she took me to the library that night after dinner. I brought home some books about sharks. I'd probably read as many books about shark attacks that year as I did about fictional stories about gallant horses and child sleuths. Dad sat by me while I opened the first book. Certain sharks, I discovered, can't breathe if they stop swimming. They have to move, or they can't breathe. That's like me, I said. What do you mean? He asked. I can't stop moving either. Dad thought about this and then said, well, you like sharks, right? I did. Well, sharks are the toughest thing ever, he said. What do you want, to be a little dolphin? Would you rather be a kitten? No way. Sharks get whatever they want. A shark can punch the whole world in the face and then just swim away. That's going to be you. A couple of weeks later, Dad came home from work agitated. Josh has Tourette's syndrome, he told my mom during dinner. My little sister Megan babbled away in her high chair. She was too chubby, and her head was as round and seamless as a bowling ball, a messy bowling ball. What? I was talking to a guy at work, and he said his boy's doing some of the things Josh is doing. And? And his boy has Tourette's syndrome. And? Said my mom. What do you mean, and? What's Tourette's syndrome? I asked, twirling a bunch of spaghetti on my fork and flying it over my plate. My mom said, what are you talking about? Isn't that that thing where people just yell and swear all the time? Josh doesn't have that. She looked at me. You have to eat your salad, Josh. Swearing is bad, I said. My dad pushed food around his plate in a circle. Well, I was talking to the guy, and it sounds a lot like, you know. The ticking clock was the only noise until my mom drummed her fingernails on the table and then tapped the pitcher of water with her fork. Ding. Megan giggled. Well, Mom said, maybe we should investigate it a little more, but don't make up your mind yet. She poured herself a glass of water and held it for a while, not drinking. My dad nodded and turned to me. What do you think about all this, buddy? He asked. I stood up on my chair. I don't care. I'm a shark.
So your mother starts looking into this. I mean, you write about, and you describe her as being kind of incredulous about it and really unnerved. And this book that she was reading, you say, made it sound like Tourette syndrome was this life sentence of perversion.
Yeah, according to her, she keeps looking for the book that it was and can't figure out exactly which one it was. But yeah, the book was full of case study after case study of these poor little boys. It's like 75% more common in males than in females.
Right.
Who were either exposing themselves in public or they couldn't stop grabbing other children or biting them and they needed to be kept home. And so, yeah, I mean, it made her kind of nervous, but she could look at that and then look at me and say, well, if that's Tourette's syndrome, I don't think that's what Josh has. So she kind of filed it away, but she also went and tried to find some role models for me with Tourette's. Mm. This is a very hard thing to do, and it was apparently even worse back then. But all she could turn up with the librarian's help was there was some speculation that Mozart may have had Tourette's.
Right.
Wouldn't impress any six-year-old boy. And that some of the poor people they burned in the Salem witch trials may not have, in fact, been possessed by devils, but were just born with a movement disorder under the terrible eye of Cotton Mather.
They didn't dwell on it at first, you say, at the beginning. And in fact, you say they they figured, if he's not in danger, we're going to just sort of keep our worries to ourselves and let you sort of live your life. I mean, they were worried, I guess, how people would treat you and all those kinds of things. But they kind of left you alone, which you say at least early on was kind of a good thing.
In hindsight, I think absolutely. And I give them a lot of credit for that. And I hope I can be that kind of parent if I ever need to. Anyone who has kids, I think, will probably agree that when you have any sudden unknown in your child's life, I mean, you worry, you do.
Yeah.
And maybe it's irrational, or probably it's irrational. I've always tended to really start dreaming up the worst case scenarios right away. But once they realized, I mean, I was still happy. It didn't seem to be on my mind much. They didn't really seem the point in making sure it was on my mind all the time. So we wouldn't really have to talk about it specifically until I brought it to them later.
Yeah. We're going to get to more of this as we go along, but I want to bring up this question, this question of faith. You were born, raised Mormon. Your parents were devoted Mormons. Again, I want to get to some of the particulars, but you throughout the book, we see these references to faith, to this idea of belief. And I wanted to ask you about your mother, because you say your mother, for example, gardened, for example, for many of the same reasons she practiced Mormonism. First, her parents did it, but you say it also gave her a sense of purpose. It was a source of beauty. And at one point, you describe your mother as part caterpillar, weaving this cocoon of euphemisms around herself, giving purpose to life and seeing the best in things. Talk about that. Talk about how you're seeing your mother's faith reflected in your struggles with doubt throughout your life.
You know, that's a good question. My mom is as kind and loving and as devout a Mormon as you'll find. And she has always been the most joyful, playful person I ever knew. But church was a deadly serious thing for us. I mean, because when you realize what the stakes are, I mean, of course, they simply couldn't be higher. We're talking about this brief life, which determines everything that will come next. So I didn't really put any thought into this. I mean, I don't think many kids do.
Right.
Until I would start having some real challenges with my own body and would need to confront some of my own ideas about what I think any of us are owed in this life, or whether the things that happen to us are rewards or punishments, and whether we can do anything to change that. And when you're a person of faith, I think just about any faith, it really does creep into everything, and it colors your relationship with your body and your ideas about whether there's a soul.
Yeah.
And as my struggle went on, my mom was the one who kept saying there's a reason for everything. And I wanted to believe that and also didn't want to believe that.
Yeah.
And I think anybody who has ever been through something hard, meaning everybody who hears this, has probably had moments like that. You know, like, why this? Why me? Why not? And so it was really hard for me to think about that in a productive way until I started to question, well, maybe it's – what if this life is all I get?
Yeah.
And at that point, I'm not saying I do or don't endorse that view currently. I just it changed things. How I thought became more important than what I thought.
Yeah.
Because what I had thought before was this is the answer to everything, and I have to make everything else fit into this no matter what. All the trials, all the questions, they'll all be answered later. And when I die, just think about how still I'll be able to sit in the next life.
Yeah.
And it was enough for a long time. And then some things changed.
Yeah, they did change. We'll get to that as we go along. Josh Hanagarny is with us. His book is called The World's Strongest Librarian, a memoir of Tourette's, faith, strength, and the power of family. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, a conversation with librarian and writer Josh Hanagarny. Hanagarny is almost defined in some ways with his relationship to books. He describes being a librarian as a state of mind. So being surrounded by books helped him maintain silence and self-control, which is helpful because he also has Tourette syndrome. He's written a memoir about the challenges of Tourette's, but it's also about faith and family and, of course, strength. The book is called The World's Strongest Librarian. So you write about your father was really worried about how the kids were going to treat you. And it turns out kids are kids. There were the cruel ones. The bookmobile became a refuge for you.
Yes.
And this is interesting because your taste in books when you were a kid are so interesting because you took to Stephen King pretty early on. It's funny because you talk about Beverly Cleary, you know, the Ramona the Brave, on one hand, and Stephen King on the other. It's a very odd mixture there. But you were all over the map all the time, maybe.
Yeah,
huh?
I mean, books were books. It really didn't matter. And I didn't, you know, my first taste of Stephen King was simply that the biggest book I saw in the bookmobile was The Tommyknockers.
Yeah.
That was my taste. More pages equaled more quality. That's it.
More quality, or also more refuge too? More time to be to yourself? Did you ever think it that way?
I've never thought about it that way. It just doesn't matter. I mean, I've just always loved books. A good story can't be too long.
Yeah. There's a moment after you'd been bullied and taunted by this terrible Jason Lawson. and you're there in the back of the family van on the way home. And you said this. You said, "I hate God. I love the devil."
Yeah. I whispered. I mean, So this is in fifth grade. Things are getting pretty intense.
Yes.
And so Jason was the first. You know, I want to make it clear. I don't think I had a harder time in school than anyone else.
Really?
No, I don't. I had friends. I had my family. I had people who would stick up for me. I felt safe. Other kids were also getting bullied. You know, but for me, the insecurities and challenges of being a kid were amplified a little bit just because if I worried about whether people like me, that might make my tics worse in a way that would call attention to me.
Yeah.
So I, Jason had gotten the whole class to look at me and laugh at me. And like he would blink his eyes like I was. And he'd always do it while he was staring into a book, you know, because he was me.
Yeah. And that was you.
Yeah, yeah. And there was this day where we were in the bookmobile and I tried to win him over. I had started reading. One weekend when my mom wouldn't take me to the library, I started reading my sister's Sweet Valley High books and just got hooked on like – and you laugh. But, you know, any of you guys out there who watched all of Alias or all of anything like – you know about long arc narrative even if it doesn't seem well suited to you.
Right.
So I read all these and I was at the bookmobile and I was up in line and I the bookmobile driver said, "Are you sure you want this?" And I was holding up this special double issue of like a – Elizabeth and Jessica's Wakefield's trip to Paris, and they're on the cover of this book just laughing about something in Paris. And she holds it up, and Jason Lawson sees this and starts snorting. So I turn to him, and I kind of say, well, don't you think they're cute? You know, trying to appeal, if nothing else, to his sense of lust.
Yeah.
And he just laughed. And so that night, I went home, and I asked God to melt Jason Lawson's face. The next day was the day he was still fine. And after walking home from school that day, was when, for some reason, I crawled into the back of the family van in the driveway. And yeah, I whispered, I hate God. I love the devil. Just, I don't know why, to kind of see. And it felt like I'd come to this terrible impasse. And maybe.
Was it a test?
I don't know. I mean, who knows? I'm not convinced that any of us really know why we do things, why we do the things we do as much as we think we do. And for kids, I think it's way, way worse.
You know, what's interesting hearing you talk about it like this is I'm reading way too much of it into the book then. I mean, I'm seeing these parts where I'm saying, oh, here are these clues to his, you know, sort of eventual doubt about faith and all those kinds of things. And you were just sort of
– you know, you might be right.
Really?
I mean, we could both be right. Who knows? I mean, and I'd probably come up with something like that if I were to write an English paper on this book.
Yeah. Mm.
So maybe – I mean, again, is there stuff in there that means more than I think? Maybe.
Yeah. There is a time when you go out for the basketball team. And we should mention you're 6'7". Mm-hmm. How tall were you when you went out for the basketball? I mean, you were really tall, so it seemed like an obvious thing. I mean, he's going to be good at basketball. And it turns out you were.
I was a freshman in high school when I played my first – I mean, the first high school team I made, sort of like Little League or the Powell League or whatever it was called. I bet I was – at least 6'4". I mean, when I got my driver's license at 16, I believe I was 6'7" at that point.
Wow.
And I weighed like 150 pounds.
Yeah,
so
right.
Tall, but scrawny. Yeah. And so yeah, I had always been pretty athletic. I definitely was not some wonder kid right away at basketball, but I got good really quickly.
But I'm interested in that. Why? Because this was something you could focus on? I mean, you really worked at it.
Both. Yeah. I mean, you practice something, you get better.
Yeah.
I had just never really had a coach. You know, when you played in Powell, it was always somebody's dad was the coach.
Yeah.
And it was more about like making sure everybody got enough time. And now I was actually having to go to practice every night for an hour or two and really drill. And I think it wasn't much different than when a person starts learning any skill that they're raw at. When you start, your first plateaus are a long way away.
You write about being – there's a moment during a really close game with this rival team. It's Hawthorne where the crowd really picks on your tics. And this is the time you say – it was later when you told your folks it's time for me to see a doctor. What was it about that moment? You wanted some answers?
Well, what had happened was this was an incredibly bitter rivalry. Our teams hated each other. Our coaches hated each other. The crowds hated each other, and you could watch the cheerleaders glare at each other across the court, our cheerleaders and their cheerleaders. It was bad. And the game came down to me having to shoot free throw after free throw. So I'm all alone on this free throw line, and the crowd is chanting, "Twitch, twitch, twitch. And so I'm so furious because I want to win. And I'm so furious because I'm thinking, how dare they? But I've also got these tears in my eyes because I didn't know I'd been having tics during the game. Yeah. And so we won. And when I came out of the locker room afterwards, I was feeling pretty sassy. And then there was this big line of guys waiting for me. And as soon as I came out, they all just started jerking and twitching. And my parents drove me home because they had made the drive and I didn't take the bus home. And that's when I said, I want to go to the doctor. I need to know if this is something we can deal with or if it's actually a thing.
Yeah.
Because at the time, we didn't have a name for it and didn't know, like, I mean, is this a behavior? Am I possessed? What? I mean, I just didn't know. I couldn't explain myself.
Yeah. So you go see a doctor at the neurology clinic at the University of Utah. And this is where it has a name. How did you – that must have been a comfort knowing, oh, this is a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And when he said – I mean when you get diagnosed with something, the question is what now? And so he laid out the options for Tourette's, which is pretty much just pills, although there's not really a Tourette's drug. It's always something like a blood pressure medication that has shown some success maybe. And all the side effects were bad enough that he said, I can't really recommend these if you don't feel like this is really prohibiting you from doing the things you want. And so I was kind of surprised to hear myself say, I don't want anything. You know, yeah. I think it's enough for now that I can explain it. And it was because at the time it was a hassle and it wore me out, but I wasn't really damaging myself yet. And for the people who liked me, of which there were plenty, it was kind of an endearing thing, you know, just more like a quirk.
Yeah. There's a part in the book where you describe – you gave your Tourette's a name, Misty. Right? I mean, this is how you refer to it, or short for Miss T. Misty.
Yeah. My mom – I remember having a conversation with my mom where I was trying to tell her, it's just too hard. I'm going to stay home from school. And she said, no, you can't let this thing make your decisions for you.
Right.
And that was the first time where I just suddenly it was in my head that this was this other thing, which led to it being this other person, which was a woman because I was like 13 and I was firing on all cylinders.
Right.
And yeah, so it was a woman. It was Miss Tourette's and then it became Miss T. And of course, you know, when I think about her, she was just stunning. And so if she had to be following me around, at least she was really hot and I was lucky in that way. But yeah, I mean, once it got in my head, it just kind of stuck the way certain things stick in your head.
Yeah. I want to have you read another section of the book. There's this part where you describe how it feels, you know, what it's like to have tics and this is how you put it, to need to have tics. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that, to need to have tics?
Well, let me read this.
Yeah.
And then if it hasn't answered your question, ask again. Think of what it feels like when you need to sneeze. You become aware of it slowly. First, there's an itch. Maybe you wiggle your nose or squint to scratch it, but the itch builds up until you let it out. Of course, you could hold the sneeze in, but what happens if you stifle it? There's no relief or resolution. It feels wrong. You sneeze so that feeling is expelled. When I have a tic, whether it's a noise or a movement, it's similar to the urge to sneeze. There's a pressure that builds up in my eyes if I want to blink, in my forehead if I want to wrinkle it, in my shoulders if I want to jerk them up towards my ears, in my tongue if I need to feel the edge of it slide against a molar, in my throat if I need to hum or yell or whistle. The urge can also be everywhere at once, which results in a tic where I flex every part of my body, hard and fast. Wherever it is, sooner or later I have to let it out, but the relief doesn't last long. The pressure might fade, rebuild, and jump out again in a few seconds, a few minutes, or longer. I can hold a tic in if I really try, but there's a price to pay for doing that. It seems that for me, I must release a specific intensity of tics each day. I can meet it out in lots of small tics, or I can hold it in and have it rage out in a blast when I get home from work, like a clogged steam valve on a radiator. I hold it in on airplanes, in meetings, in church, in classrooms, and whenever possible at the reference desk. For the rest of the book, you can assume that I'm always having tics. I thought about writing the noises into the dialogue, but that quickly became so obnoxious that your experience reading this book would have been just as annoying as it is to actually have the tics. So here's what I'll do. In the coming chapters, when I experience new, significant tics, I'll say so. Once I've had a new type of tic, you can assume that it stays in the rotation. Each new tick is stacked on top of what came before it.
So, and I should say, we get this image. I like that part of the book in the sense that it gives you a sense of here's a new personality of a tick. It's a new character also almost in some way. It builds one upon the other, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, it just comes – it gets to the point where it's hard to separate one from the next and figure out, is this 10 things in a sequence? Is it one big tick that has 10 parts? Which when you start trying to take it apart and figure out how to deal with all the different things that are happening, it can make it a real challenge.
Yeah.
Keeps it lively.
But you say that if you hold in a tick, there's a price you pay.
Yeah. I mean, right now, if my wife was here and you said, Josh, the next time you have a tick, I'm going to shave her head. My wife has lovely hair. I don't want her to be bald. I could grip my teeth. And we could probably have a staring contest for a few hours if we really needed to.
Wow.
But it wouldn't feel good to me. It would feel awful increasingly as each minute passed. And then when I finally would get to have the tics, when you relented and said she can keep her hair, then it would look worse than it would otherwise and sound worse and be worse for me, you know, because that's when the pipe blows.
Yeah. You write about how you go on this LDS mission, for example, and how your relationship with your Tourette's was getting painful, how Misty, as you called her, wasn't violent but a repetitive strain that was taking a toll on your joints. Is this diminishing you physically, Tourette's?
Well, what happened on my mission was up until that point, again, it had just kind of been a hassle more than anything.
Yeah.
And I was in Washington, D.C., and I actually was walking down the street one day and I hit myself in the face really hard. And my nose was bleeding and my companion just said, are you okay? And I said, I don't know. And then that whole day, just bang, 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 hitting myself. And I started screaming and I started scratching myself. And this was so different than anything that had come before. We didn't even immediately say, oh, this is that thing you got diagnosed with in high school. I don't remember. It was so different.
Yeah.
That. I mean, I probably recognized the urges, but I mean, it seemed like it might actually be something else, something worse. And of course, it was Tourette's. So yeah, what happened is I tried to stick it out, and it's very hard to be pious and reverent and try to get people who don't want to talk to you to ask the big questions and rearrange their lives to suit you when you can't even sit in their home without doing all this crazy stuff. But ultimately what would send me home was my body was convulsing so badly, so frequently, that I couldn't keep food down. So when I stepped off the airplane back in Elko, Nevada, halfway through my mission, I was like back down to my driver's license weight of 150 or 160. It was bad.
You, it's interesting. You were doing this silent screaming in your life. This came a little bit later, and which must have put a stress on your body. But you said it was giving you these. You said it was giving you these awesome 6-pack abs.
Yeah,
because you were contorting your body. It gave you a hernia, though. I mean, really. And you went around. Let's just mention you got Botox basically into your vocal cords, I suppose.
Yeah. When I came home, my dad talked me into going to the gym, if nothing else, to try to put some of the weight back on.
Yeah.
And that's where I kind of fell in love with lifting, just as a means at first of feeling like I had some control over my body.
Right.
So that was getting better and better. And yeah, that's when I was screaming so hard every 2 to 3 seconds, I got a hernia from the screaming. And so that was kind of that was one of the bottoms where I just thought, oh, I'm in serious trouble. And yeah, it was all these contractions and all this screaming. And that's when I started getting Botox, was because I wanted to be out in public. And I still had goals. I wanted to go to school. I wanted to try to get a job. So I started getting Botox injections in my vocal cords, which would make it so I couldn't scream.
Yep.
So I stopped worrying about getting a hernia for the nonce. And then I also was able to be back out in public. But I couldn't talk much either. You can probably tell I like to talk. So now I had this weird new identity of being the, you know, like the kind of twitchy guy who could still be fun and liked to be around people, to the pale guy who never left his house. And if he did, he was sitting in the back of the room and he never made a sound ever. I could whisper a tiny bit.
Yeah.
But not even enough to really make it worth trying to talk on the phone. I met my wife during that time, which was pretty interesting. And that's always also when I started writing. I realized there's nothing I love as much as talking to people and just having good conversation. And it's because I realized that's often how I and we learn what we think about things sometimes. You talk through ideas and you hear yourself think out loud. And writing became the silent version of that once I couldn't talk. And so, yeah, I got these shots for about 2 years, every 5 or 6 weeks, and then just kind of let it go.
It's interesting because you say in the book that without the noises, the ticks, the screaming to define, as you say, the real me, you didn't know exactly who you were. So you see them as part of you, of course, right?
Yeah, I kind of think you have to. I do a lot of speaking to kids, like giant groups of kids with disabilities and their parents. And one thing I always see is to really understand the life of somebody with a disability, you have to understand vulnerability. And when you go out and you have an obvious condition, it kind of robs you of the ability to make your own first impressions. And so that's kind of where I was at. So now, what does it mean? What do I say about myself if the noises I make haven't already announced you to me and forced us to have that conversation? What do I lead with? What do I say about myself?
I wanted to the idea of lifting. Again, you said your father got you into the gym. What is it that interests you about strength? What is it about strength? Because we should say you bend horseshoes, which is pretty impressive. You're going – I don't know. Are you still going for the 600-pound deadlift? Are you still working for that or did you get there yet?
You know, I am. One of the challenges I have is that I'm always hurt because of the tics. So if I tell you that 10 weeks from now I'm going to enter a deadlift competition and I'm doing this 10-week program to help me peak at the end, somewhere in that 10 weeks I will get hurt. And I will have to start doing something else. So among seriously strong people, my numbers are not going to impress anybody. Like guys in my weight class can lift maybe even double what I can in all the big lifts. For me, the point is getting stronger than yesterday. That number can get smaller instead of bigger, you know, because I always am just forced to do whatever I can do without pain because my body's got such weird mileage on it.
Yeah.
And my joints, you know, as far as why strength? Again, like libraries, I'd say, why not? It's sad when you start to feel like fitness itself is becoming a fringe activity and we're all starting to be shaped like the chairs we sit in. There's no downside to taking care of your body, and I think you can only think as well as you can move in some ways, and you can move better if your tissue is actually stronger. And it gives you something you can measure. And for me, that's what it was. I only saw this in hindsight, but it's the only time every day where I feel like I'm in control of my body. But it's also – there's nothing abstract about it. It's a number.
Yeah.
And you can measure it. And maybe getting better doesn't make you super confident all of a sudden. But it's hard not to feel more confidence when you are always getting better at something and you can prove it and you can see it. And a lot of the kids I meet who are doing the best with their disabilities have something they've really latched onto that they can be proud of and that they can improve at and that they can demonstrate it.
Yeah.
And again, none of us are ever going to get everything we want. But for me, this was what taught me that every situation actually can be improved and that you got to find a way to win at something and you have to be okay with it if all you can do is win at something really, really small.
Do the tics go away in the gym?
Pretty much. But there's been kind of a misconception that the weights have helped my tics. They actually generally make them worse. But again, it's the control I have every day that makes all of the uncontrollable stuff more livable. I just I can only lift for 1 hour or so a day versus the other 23 where I gotta be me.
Josh Hanegarny is with us. His book is called The World's Strongest Librarian, a memoir of Tourette's, faith, strength, and the power of family. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Josh Hanegarny is with us. We're talking about his memoir. It's The World's Strongest Librarian, a memoir of Tourette's, faith, strength, and the power of family. So Let's talk about Adam Glass. Really seems like a pretty influential character in this story in your life.
Yeah, Adam was. You know, let me start here. So I had married Jeanette, and the next few years were kind of hard because I was still really not up to working consistently and doing school consistently. Mentally, I just, you know, it doesn't matter if I couldn't or I didn't make myself, the result was the same.
Yeah.
So for a while, we had this kind of sad, unequal partnership. When I started working at the library and things started getting a little better, I felt like I had mentally turned this corner. And that's when I really started just to lift obsessively and just more results equals more control for me. You know, stronger equals better. That anyway, when you start looking for ways to learn about getting stronger online, you find these different communities and you start running into the same people over and over again. Adam Glass was this incredibly gruff, scary-looking Air Force tech sergeant based in Minot, North Dakota. And he could do all this crazy stuff that I'd never seen. Like he could take a frying pan and roll it up with his hands and put it through a wristwatch. And he could take a deck of playing cards. And with his thumb and forefinger, he could pinch a piece out of the middle of it like a hole punch. And I have seen him lift 500 pounds on one finger. And like it looks like CGI while you're seeing it. You think it can't be real. Anyway, so I wanted to learn how to do this stuff. So I sent Adam an email and said, well, could I come up with you and train for a week and learn how to do this stuff? Because when you see somebody bench press a lot of weight, you can pretty much guess that they got there by doing a lot of benching.
Yep.
When you try to roll up a frying pan and it doesn't work, there's really no logical first step. So I wanted him to try to help me get to some of these places. Anyway, so Adam picks me up. He would later tell me he was autistic, which made our first uncomfortable meeting much clearer because he didn't even say hi to me. It was so weird. Anyway, for that week, we talked about a lot of things. And Adam had suffered a brain injury during a prison riot in Iraq where he was kind of the equivalent of a warden. And at that time, a lot of things in his brain changed. And he would tell you that he's always been different. But this is when he started to get really fascinated with movement and started to see everything as movements. And it didn't matter whether it was bench pressing a weight or playing a scale on the piano or a thought moving from point A to point B, you know, along your neural paths and my tics.
Yeah.
He would say any movement, anything you can consider a movement can be considered – it can be made more skillful. And when I see you have tics, I see unskilled movements. And so we'd have these weird circular Socratic conversations where he wouldn't tell me anything, but he'd lead me towards questions he'd want me to ask. The scope of this is really beyond – you know, Adam's going to get his own book, I think. I really hope. And so we'll be able to do more of this later. What I'll say is that Adam gave me some things to try when I went home. That was in September of 2009, and in November of 2009, I was able to sit still after 30 years of trying for 60 seconds with no distractions, no nothing. And so, yeah, beyond influential. But again, when I called him and said, I did it, he said, I know, turn it into 2 minutes. And then he hung up, and that's just like kind of how it is. I was able to turn that minute into 5 and then into 10 and then an hour. And, you know, the day came where I realized I'd had most of a year without any tics to speak of. Jeanette, my wife, said I was still doing small things, but so small, it was like it didn't even matter. And I was telling people I was cured and I really thought we had done something cutting edge. I still think that's true, although I'm obviously not cured. I'm far worse today at 35 than I was during the worst times I write about in the book. But I had this year off because of some of these things I worked on with Adam. And then when it all roared back for different reasons that I suspect, what I suddenly had was a memory. I now had a memory of what it felt like.
Yeah.
And I think we figured some things out that worked for a while. And Tourette's is a moving target, so some things changed. But when I used to have really bad spells, it would come with the sickening dread where I would just feel like I had to grip my teeth and wonder, when will this stop? And all I could do was wait it out because we had already asked all the questions that doctors ask. And although they've helped many, many people with Tourette's, never did much for my case. And that's what I've got out of Adam now is when it sets in badly again, my thoughts are more things like, what am I not seeing? What am I not asking? What else could I try? Sometimes that gets me somewhere, sometimes it don't. or it doesn't. But it's a type of hope I didn't have before, or maybe a more productive way to hope, because it actually is based in actions. And that's the main thing I got out of Adam that I think will follow me through my whole life.
Let me ask you this finally. We've got about a minute left. You write in the book about how you learn when you enter a new room, the change in the lighting will make you have tics. And you have these certain ways of dealing with all of this. And I wondered if finally, do you think about it as something that is just something that is a resource that will eventually spend you? You know, it's something that's going to deplete you physically. I mean, how are you thinking about it today?
I fully expect to be worse at 50 than I am at 35. I mean, I've hit a couple of rough patches where I've had to realize what I thought was the answer is not the answer. And again, that's one of the reasons I'm at the library. There's always more questions to ask. So yeah, I'm only 35. I think my body's probably older. I am currently getting worse. And that's one of the reasons I train right now. Aging well, or as well as possible, has become a goal in itself, and I'm trying to give myself the best chance of staying ahead of it physically. But I also don't know, and it is the uncertainty that makes life exhilarating. I mean, it is probably just as likely that 2 years from now I'll be in the middle of another year off because I'll have figured out the right things to do. I hope so. I'm no longer counting on it, but we'll see. Cross your fingers.
Josh Hanagarny. His book is called The World's Strongest Librarian, a memoir of Tourette's, faith, strength, and the power of family. Josh, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Duncan. It's a pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.